And they love the presentation. Oh, and by the way, I had some extra time. I went to Yankee Stadium before they tore it down. And then they signed the deal. Everything's okay. They're on board. Happy days, boss. Now, what's the parenthetical statement in there? It's the little statement about what? About the Yankee Stadium. That's right, Yankee Stadium. And why did I bring that up? Well, I didn't tell you this. It's because I know my boss. I know my audience. He's a baseball fan, and he loves Yankee Stadium. So I inserted that. Well, almost 100% of what Alex covered 2 weeks ago, and 100% of what David covered last week, and 100% of what I covered this week is really one giant parenthetical statement. Do you remember that Alex 2 weeks ago said, I'm not going to talk about it, but I want you to know that the writer brings up in chapter 5, verse 10, that Jesus has a high priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. And he just brings it up, and the moment he brings it up, then he drops the subject and he goes some other direction. And so I'm going to have a slide put on the screen behind me. Everything from 5:10 is really a parenthetical statement. It's actually a very long and complicated one. If I had done it, I would have forgotten my original subject. That's because I'm an absent-minded speaker. I cannot get too far off track or I forget where I started. But this writer doesn't do that. So I'm going to just review where we've been and where we're going to go. In 5:10, the author brings up the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Then from 5:11 through 6:3, and Alex covered this, he assesses the maturity of the believers, the Hebrew Christians. And that's not a good assessment at all. It's a very negative one. Then last week, David covered from chapter 6, 4 through 8, and he warns his audience in no uncertain terms of the severity of their stubbornness and their waywardness. And now I'm going to cover beginning in verse 9 through 12, and he begins now to soften. I think it's because of the harshness of the warning. Do you remember the warning last week? Do you remember how harsh it was? It's because of the harshness of the warning now that he's going to actually begin to mitigate the warning a little bit and begin to speak in a very assuring way to those believers. And then finally, in chapter 6, verses 13 through 20, we're going to cover that today, he not only begins to tie in and tie up all the loose ends about the warning passage, but somehow, amazingly, he ends up in the very last verse of the 6th chapter, exactly where he was at the very beginning, 5:10, talking about the priesthood of Jesus after the order of Melchizedek. Now, David Anderson covered, like I said, the warning last week, and the warning is written in shockingly negative and harsh language. The author probably has in mind, because he brought it up in chapter 4, the memory of Israel's ancient history, when a whole generation who left Egypt full of hope and promise, they went into the wilderness, they became hardened and stiff-necked, and God judged them. And it was a whole generation wasted. Their lives were wasted. They spent 40 years in limbo in the wilderness. You know, Pastor Ray Stedman once was at a Billy Graham convention, and when it was over, or a crusade, I should say, he slipped into a bus seat next to a young man who had made a profession of faith that night in Jesus Christ. And he began to tell that man as they were driving back to the church that what his new life in Christ would be like. And he shared many, many things. And then he came and he made a point about being free from any future fear of death. And that's when the young man began to talk to Pastor Stedman. And he said, you know, I'm actually, as a young man, I'm not very afraid to die. Maybe I'm too young to have those fears. But I'll tell you what I am afraid of. I'm afraid that without God in my life, I'll waste my life. Well, that's what the author to the Hebrews is concerned about. And that's why his warnings are so severe. He's worried that just as in the olden days, a whole generation, except for two men, wasted their lives, he wants that there not to be a repeat of Israeli history in this congregation. So he warns them severely in the way that Moses warned them back in the days of Exodus and Numbers, those kinds of books. Is that the character of the warning really, and David kind of hinted at this last week, it's really a very Mosaic-like warning. Because I think that, like I said before, I'm repeating myself, I think the author has in mind a carbon copy situation is developing, just like that first generation of Israelites that left Egypt. This first generation of early Christians is about to do the same thing that first generation did. And this is a first generation too. So he's going to warn them not to harden their hearts and not to become lazy in their spiritual lives. And so he warns them, and then I don't think he even takes a breath. Because I think he knows how severe and how hard those words are. And so, and I'm going to put the text behind me. If you have your Bible open, turn to chapter 6, verse 9. And let's take a look at how he begins now. I love to have this section of the chapter. He begins to assure them and to show them they do have confidence before God. Verse 9. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things. See that? Things that belong to salvation. For God is not so unjust as to overlook your work and the love you have shown for his sake in serving the saints, as you still do. See, as they are still. They're not quite like that generation in the wilderness yet. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance, that's why I'm saying this passage will be about assurance, of hope until the end. So that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. I don't know about you, but I like those cooling words after the blast furnace that David Anderson covered last week. We feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation, for God is not so unjust to overlook your work. Now, let's just broaden the context from that original audience to this audience. Because God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. You know that when I look at some of the old-timers in this church, I have never kept a record, I have never kept a book, and my memory isn't sufficient to keep track of all the good things people have done in this church 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But I can tell you this, that God is eternal to remember. He will never overlook the things that you do in service of him or for his name's sake, as it says here. You know, God will never take the things that he knows and he will never bury them. Do you know that there's a saying in the newspaper business that if you have a piece of news that you really don't want to publish, but it would be unethical as a journalist to not publish it, you know what they do with articles like that? It says they bury them in the middle or the back of the newspaper, like section D, page 33. What this passage is saying is that God will never take his knowledge and bury it. When it comes to the things that his people do for his sake, they'll always be front page and the top of the fold when you go and you meet with him one day. That's the kind of assurance he wants them. Do you know how earth-shattering it will be for one day you to stand on your own? You know, you all sing as a chorus here, but one day we'll all get before God and we're going to sing solo. And that's going to be a day, it's going to be a tough day. But I want you to remember something and never let this go. God will never bury the information. If you are standing in his grace, the information he knows about you will always be information that will be your friend. And this passage indicates that God doesn't just remember the big things. You know, if you were Billy Graham and you had pulled off, like, I don't know, how many crusades has Billy Graham done? Hundreds! You think God remembers everyone? I don't remember everyone, but God does. But there are passage after passage in the New Testament that emphasizes that God remembers the little things that people do in his name. He's infinite to remember. Kind words and a smile to a stranger in his name. Now, is that a little thing or what? Just giving a person a smile and a nod of a head. A cup of water in his name in another passage. A bit of hospitality in his name in another passage. A visit, a card, a word of counsel in his name. And you know what? This passage says God is not so unjust to ever overlook those things. They are like acid etched in a divine mind. Now, before I move on, I just want to point out one more point. And it goes to this whole thing about, will you be assured and confident, and will you be poised before God when you see him one day? Because I think that fundamentally, the more you stray from God, the more that you begin to cool in your enthusiasms for God, you begin to lose your poise and your confidence before God. And he knows that about his audience. And so he says something, and it's hard to follow the thought, but there's an interesting human psychology in verse 11, and it says this, "And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end." In other words, there's something about being earnest in your spiritual life that inevitably leads to an assurance. And vice versa is true. If you slip into spiritual sluggishness, it leads in your own mind to uncertainty at first and anxiety at worst. And when you're in the work, though, here's what the writer to the, you know, he knows something about how God hardwired all of us. When you're in the work, in your father's business, and you're working hard in your father's business, you build family identity. You build confidence. You don't have any question when you're laboring in earnest for your in your father's business. You know you're a son. You know you're a daughter. And your earnestness, in a sense, proves it, not to other people, but to yourself. From out of earnestness comes confidence and assurance before God. Now, this is what is taught in other places in the Bible, that arising out of earnestness and the works of faith that proceed out of faith comes confidence. I put a passage now behind me from 1 John chapter 2, verses 28, 29, and I just want you to see that basically other writers of the New Testament argue the same way. But this is from John, and he says this, chapter 2, verse 28, "And now, little children," this is a typical way that John would address an audience, "abide in him, so that when he appears, you will have confidence and not shrink back from him in shame at his coming." Right? Abide in him. But then he goes on a step farther and he talks about righteousness leads to assurance. And he says, "For you know that he is righteous, and you may be assured that everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him." In other words, John contrasts abiding in Christ and confidence, and not abiding and not practicing righteousness, with shame before God. This is what that original audience, it may not be appropriate for everyone in this room right now, but that original audience was losing their assurance and their confidence before God. And when you've just received, the original audience, I'm saying, the scathing warning that the audience received when they read that, you know that you would begin to shrink. You would begin to lose your confidence before God. Because that's what warnings do sometimes. They make you question your identity. And that's exactly what he sees here. I put a chart now before you. It's actually on the screen behind me. Here's what happened, I think, to this audience. First, they let the enthusiasms of their faith cool. That's something that we can do very easily, ladies and gentlemen. That's something I can do. Then you become sluggish in your service. I have heard people in this church say, quote unquote, "I paid my dues. I was a Sunday school teacher for blank, blank, blank years, and I'm never going to do it again. I'm on autopilot now. I paid my dues." Well, they became sluggish in their service. Then they began to lose, inevitably, they began to lose poise and confidence before God and others. And then, when your own internal voice begins to question your genuineness, you know what that is? That's just plain old-fashioned shame. And shame always, always causes you before God to shrink back. Always. Always. Do you remember the story of Adam and Eve? When they ate the fruit they weren't supposed to eat? And God came into the garden the very next time after they ate the fruit? Did they go in poise and confidence and tell God that they made a mistake? No, they shrank back and they hid from him. That's shame. And that's what shame does a really good job, is that it distances you. Your shame will distance you. Now, I'm going to put another verse on the screen because I think, and I'm just going to emphasize this, that there is actually a strong sub-theme in the whole book of Hebrews that deals with this whole issue of how do you get back your confidence and your poise before God? How can you really, as a sinner, be confident before a holy and a righteous being? That's a real fundamental question, and the author actually has brought it up. He's reminded his audience that he knows what they're thinking in chapter 4, verse 13, and he says, "And no creature is hidden from his sight," that's intimidating, "but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. Now, at the risk of being too heavy for my audience today, I want to share with you a very important sub-theme from the book of Hebrews. The writer knows that his audience has guilt and shame. And that makes them, and at us at times, unable to bear the scrutiny of God. Sometimes when we're wayward in our faith, we can't even withstand our own scrutiny, and we build all sorts of coping mechanisms to deal with it. The book of Hebrews is full of all sorts of intellectual arguments, theological arguments for the mind about why Christ is better than the angels, or why Christ is better than Moses, or why Christ's priesthood is better than the old Aaronic priesthood. But that isn't all the book of Hebrews is about. The arguments and the exhortations are there to re-stimulate earnestness, to use the word from the passage today, to flee from sin and sluggishness. And when you do, you will see a reawakening of assurance and confidence and wholeness before God. I want you to be aware of this because it is a big theme. I know that we say the theme, and it is true. The previous preachers have done an excellent job saying, here is a group of Jews who made a profession for Christ. And the main theme of the book, the main reason the book is being written, is because they ran into social and religious ostracism, the confiscation of their properties and things like that. And so they were tempted to say, well, it would be easier to just sort of go with the flow of my neighbors and go back to the temple and submit myself to the old Aaronic priesthood. But there's another theme. He knows it. It's more deep. It's more primal. He's dealing with an audience that has lost their confidence before God. And he knows that. And that's why this book, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, and so I'm going to put another chart up on how many times this book emphasizes the themes of assurance. Like being confident to appear before God or to enter the holy places. You know, that theme appears 6 times in this book. Drawing near to God, which is another way of saying the same thing, appears 3 times in the book. The assurance of faith appears 2 times in the book, and the confession of an abiding, lasting hope appears 7 times. I think the writer knows that most people's fundamental problems in their lives are really essentially religious, and they deal with things like lack of confidence and shame and guilt. And so what he's doing is he's going at it at 2 different angles. First come intellectual arguments, because the mind has to know why they are assured of access to God. The mind has to know that. But then he comes in with exhortations because he knows that when you're wayward and you're not earnest in your faith anymore, that in itself breeds a kind of intimidation factor and a lack of genuineness. In your own heart, privately, you wonder about your own genuineness sometimes. And so the writer wants to argue, and he will do it in this passage, that there is something that is so much better now than existed before. The argument isn't ever in this book that the old covenant was bad and the new covenant is better. It's just that the old covenant was good and the new covenant is better. That's the argument he makes. Because it's only in the new covenant that you can actually gain lasting, abiding assurance and confidence and poise before God. That's the reason why he argues like this. Now, let me reread verses 11 and 12 again in light of wanting and working as a pastor's heart to take a group of people who are wayward and who have lost their poise and assurance before a God who sees everything. And he says in verse 11, "And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises." That's the heart of the author for this audience and anyone who ever reads this book. Now, I don't know if I'm gaining traction with any of you, but there is a tendency to slip and slide in the Christian life. There is. It just is. It's a fact. Every elder in here acknowledges that. We guard against it in our own lives, and we try to guard against it in the audience, in the congregation's life. But there's just a tendency to wander. That creates always a bit of an identity crisis. Sometimes it can be very mild, but some of it, people can actually begin to doubt their eternal salvation. And that leads to anxiety before God. And how do you get that back? Well, that's exactly one of the major sub-themes of the book is not confidence on just an intellectual level, but down in here. How will I one day stand before a God who knows everything I've ever done? Well, one of the things that he's drawing your attention to in this passage, before I go on to verse 13, is that the knowledge of God is your friend. It will always be your friend if you stand in grace. That's the first argument he's making. Whatever you have done, it doesn't remember if you remember everything. It doesn't even matter if it's a petty thing in your estimation. God will never forget it. He'll never bury that knowledge. It'll always be front page, top of the fold, when you appear before him. Now that takes me to the next verses and how the writer will tie up the loose ends from this long parenthetical thought. But amazingly, he has the ability to go right back and tie the loose ends together with the high priesthood of Jesus. I'm just amazed. Actually, I'm amazed that he can do this. Like I said, this pitiful preacher, if I went this far off subject, I'd totally forget where I was, and I'd be looking at you and saying, now, where did I start again? What was the point I originally was bringing up? He doesn't do that. Now, look at verse 13, because now he's going to move step by step to try to tie up all the loose ends of this whole exhortation and bring us back to a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. Now let me just summarize this by saying what he's saying to this audience is just this, that God makes promises to people. Promises imply waiting, and waiting necessitates patience. And he's saying, I want you now to imitate Abraham, and he is the father of the faithful. He's been the father of the faithful for 2,000 years. That's how long it had been from Abraham's time into the original audience. And now he's been the father of the faithful, according to Paul, for the next 2,000 years. So it's not just to a Jewish audience he's making this appeal to Abraham. He's saying imitate Abraham because he received a promise of a physical son, a physical offspring when he was 75 years of age. And do any of you know this simple Bible fact, how long he had to wait until Isaac was born? 25 years. Alex Strauch knows that. Then he receives this unbelievable test because he has to take the son whom he loves, because he's formed a bond with that son, Isaac. And he also knows that all the promises of a seed and an offspring, and through that offspring, all the world would be blessed, which affects us today. He knows that all hinges on that single, solitary life, which was a miracle. And then what does God do in Genesis 22 a few years after that? Take your son, the son whom you love, and go to Mount Moriah and offer him there as a sacrifice unto me. And Abraham does it, and so God, he doesn't exactly do it. He comes close to doing, and then God provides a substitute for Isaac. And then God does something. I can't say that he's never done this, ever, but he does something he rarely does. In Genesis 22, right after the Isaac story, God restates all the promises from back in Genesis chapter 12, and then he does something, which might not mean much to a 21st century audience. He swears an oath to himself, or by himself, because he has no one higher. Who does God swear by? I swear to tell the whole truth, the whole truth and nothing but the whole truth, so help me God. That's who I swear by. Who does God swear by when he wants to tell the truth? That's right. He swears by the I am. He swears by himself. Now, it's important to note here, I know this is taking us way down the road, and David, I'm not stepping on your toes, but there's another time God makes swears too. Do you know when it is? It's found in, I'm not going to have you turn there, I just want to plant this seed. Psalm 110, verse 4, God also swears an oath, and he says this, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So he's bringing up this swearing idea because he's going to go two directions at the same time. It's going to cinch up all the details of the exhortation, and it's going to introduce the whole idea of this priesthood of Melchizedek. Now, how important is it that God occasionally, I went to my Bible, how many times do you think God has ever sworn an oath in the Bible? Think he does it a lot, or do you think he does it very, doesn't do it very often? He does it six times in the Bible. Two of them are really, really negative, and four of them are very positive. But only two of them apply in this passage. He swore an oath. He restated all the promises to Abraham. He swore it by an oath. And then he swears another oath that there would be a priest after the order of Melchizedek based on the power of his indestructible life. And he says, I swear and I will not change my mind. All right, now, why does God swear oaths? I know why people swear oaths, because people are unreliable. Why does God swear an oath? Well, let's go to the next verse, because he tells you why it is. Here's how the writer explains the importance of God taking an oath. Verse 17. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things, the initial promise and now the swearing by an oath, those are the two things, which is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement. Now we come back to this theme of poise and confidence and assurance before God, to hold fast to the hope set before us. Now, let me do my very, very best to try to capture this idea in an illustration of what it means for God to swear an oath. Let's say that you know, I don't know if any of you know people like this, let's say you know a man that has $1 billion in assets. And this billionaire comes to you and he says, I promise you, if you will take a long journey on my behalf, that I will purchase for you, at the end of the journey, a huge estate somewhere out here in the West. Tens of thousands of acres, rolling hills, mountaintops, streams, ponds, buildings, houses, outbuildings, fences, bridges, roads, whatever you need, and all the equipment to take care of that. And he draws up the promises in writing, and he invites you, and he brings in his staff as witnesses, and he signs that promise one day. Now, if I'm the recipient of that, I'm overwhelmed. Now, let's just say a year later that this billionaire comes back to me and he says, I know I signed the paperwork, but here is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take all the money, because I just have this giant pool of money, and I'm going to take whatever it takes to buy this estate and build everything, and I'm going to take the money out of and separate it from all my other assets, and I'm going to put it in an irrevocable trust for you. I cannot break into this, my heirs cannot break into it, and now I'm signing it before you. And you just go, wow, wow. Then he comes back to you a year later and he says, look, I want you to be so convinced of the validity of the journey I'm asking you to take, that I'm going to take, and I'm actually going to spend the money now, I'm actually going to buy the property, I'm going to develop all the buildings, I'm going to put in all the fences and all the bridges, and I'm going to build everything, and it's going to be perfect. And it's already done for you right now, and I'm going to put it back into a new irrevocable trust that neither I nor my descendants can break or change in any way. And then let's say he comes back to you a year later and he says, look, I want to so assure you more convincingly, like the author uses, that I just purchased an insurance company from an insurance company a policy. It's actually Lloyd's of London, and the value of the insurance policy is 1,000 times the value of the estate I've already purchased and built for you. That is the beginning of the idea. That's all it is the beginning of the idea of when God takes an oath. You see, in the illustration I just gave, we're only dealing with billions of dollars and irrevocable human trusts and indescribably big human insurance policies. But here we have a situation, and that's what the author is drawing your attention from. There are moments in the Bible where the Creator swears an oath to the creature. And the one who cannot lie swears an oath to the ones who cannot not lie. So that we are more exceedingly convinced. And the one with infinite resources makes and swears an oath. And in the swearing, he is saying, look, there is no fine print anywhere in the Bible, not even in the book of 2nd or 3rd Hezekiah. That was a test question. There is no book. There is no fine print anywhere in the Bible that breaks this oath. I want you more convinced, and so I swear an oath. Now remember, he swears it to Abraham, but every Jew in there knows that they are the beneficiaries of the promises of Abraham. And now, if they're thinking at all, they go, well, there was also this man that was sworn an oath to in Psalm 110. And so he goes on and he simply says this, look, if God would take these sort of steps for Abraham, if he would take it for all of Abraham's offspring, whether they are of physical descent or spiritual descent, then sometimes the journey along the way, which I've asked you to do for me, which is sometimes discouraging and sometimes it seems too long, I'm assuring you more convincingly that it's worth the effort, it's worth the cost, it's worth the devotion, it's worth the self-sacrifice, it's worth doubling up your efforts and putting your eyes back on the author and the perfecter of your faith. It's always worth that because God has taken an oath. That's what he's saying. And this is how he concludes the passage in verse 19. And we have this. That's exactly what I said. And we have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. Now, this is Old Testament language, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And now he's already back to the original subject. He's telling you that there is a lot of oath-taking that's happened, and both oaths, in a sense, have come to pass. God's oath is an anchor for our souls, but not like a ship's anchor, an anchor that descends. It's an anchor that ascends. And where does it ascend to? Into the depths of heaven. Into the holy places. No, 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 no. Into the holy of holies. No, 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 no. Into the deepest recesses of the abode of God. That is where the high priesthood of Melchizedek is right now. To a place, if I can bring up this theme again of nakedness and exposure before God, here is now a man, and he stands in a place where no shame, no sin, no shame. In this world of sin and shame and alienation, here is a man that based on the purity of his life and based on the eternality of his life, he now goes to a place that I have no power to go. But based on the indestructibility of his life and based on an oath that he received that he would be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, he's there. I can't go there. Now, one day, I will go there. That's not the point here. Is he saying there's only one man that's ever been given the power to go to this place. And he is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, and that is an anchor for our souls that reaches up into the heavens. You know, in olden times, there were only really three types of priests. There was the original type of priest, and the Old Testament saints, I mean these Christians, these Hebrews, had already forgotten that there was three types of priests. The very, very oldest type of priest was actually a king priest in the Old Testament. He received his appointment from God. He received his appointment based both on immortality and the purity of his life. And there was once a priest mentioned in the very, very, very earliest pages of the Old Testament. And he was a priest like that. He was a model and a type of the priesthood of Christ. That was the first and the oldest type of priesthood that we know of in the Bible. And this audience had forgotten it. Then there's a second oldest type, a type of priest that we would call a pagan priest. He was a counterfeit of the true priest. He knew no divine appointment. Could have been a he, could have been a she. But basically they appointed and trained themselves. They secured their influences over people's lives by claims, the ability to communicate with spirits, by magical powers, things like that. They often were hocus-pocus men and women. but they could be very shrewd and very manipulative. And they existed in olden times, and they still exist today. Now, there's the third oldest type of priesthood in the Old Testament. That's the Aaronic priesthood. And when the book of Hebrews was written, it still existed, though it does not exist today. It started with Moses' brother Aaron, and he was directly appointed by God, and he was a true priest of God, but it was a weaker priesthood than the original one and the most genuine one. And the reason it was weaker is the arguments he's going to make now for the rest of the book. He was a man that was, he was appointed as a priest, but he had a limited duration. Why? What did every priest in the Aaronic order do eventually? They died. Or they got so sick they couldn't carry on their duties. And not only that, when they were carrying on their duties, they were so weak that they were actually sinful high priests, and they first had to make atonement for their own sin. In other words, they had to get their own lives in order before they could ever represent the likes of you and me. And these priests, if you read your Old Testament, oftentimes they became more sinful than the average Israelite. And when they entered the holy place, this is the one that I love, and David will eventually get to this. When they entered the most holy place, which the Jews of that day thought, oh, that's a grand thing that happens one time a year. They entered the most holy place, and they entered for just seconds, fearful of their own lives. They got out of there as quickly as they could, just the opposite of poise and confidence with God. And then, here's the amazing thing, is that the inner place that they entered was just a copy. That's all it ever was just a copy of the true Holy of Holies, where God dwells. So now, the author, in this section now, that as we end chapter 20, this author will begin to compare and contrast the priesthood of Melchizedek to the Aaronic priesthood with cogent arguments, really, that are directed to the mind. And those arguments are supposed to take a Jewish audience that is tempted to go back and place themselves under the Aaronic priesthood and to show them there is no confidence there and there is no future there. And even if there was, why would you want good when you could have the best? The Aaronic priesthood was full of sin and shame and lack of confidence. When they went into the holy place, it was like, get me out of here as quick as you can. I have to do my duty, but I don't want to be struck dead because I am fearful when I go into the holy place. But here is a different kind of priest who comes along, and he's got an indestructible life. He's got assurance. He's got poise. His father, he calls him by father all of his life. He's always been doing his father's work. He's got the confidence that no man or woman in here has. And he has gone, not to the copy, but to the real Holy of Holies. And there, you know what he's doing? Not his own business. He's doing my business and yours. That's why you ought to trust in him. So oath-taking shows up in the book of Hebrews a whole bunch of times. And I'll close on this. Do you know that oath-taking shows up in chapter 4? Do you know what God said in chapter 4? David covered this. I swear in my wrath, they will never enter my rest. Scary, isn't it? A whole generation wasted life. Then oath-taking shows up again, right here in chapter 6. And he says, I swear, Abraham, I swear by the highest thing that exists, which is me. I swear. The creature bows down and lisps and whispers to a puny ant-like man, I swear, I will do everything I said, and I swear by my own namesake. And then he comes to another man, a man that many of you have invited into your life. And he says, I swear, I will never change my mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And he begins to say, look, this is like an anchor for your soul. And now he will take chapters and chapters to begin to lay out why this is an anchor for your soul and why you would be crazy to go anywhere else. You could go anywhere else. Why would you go anywhere else? Because everywhere else is hamburger and you could have steak. That's exactly what he's saying. Oath-taking comes into play with an oath made to a generation that wasted their lives, then another oath made to Abraham, and finally an oath made to Jesus as a high priest forever. And that, ladies and gentlemen, ought to be an anchor, ought to be an assurance, It ought to be a confidence. Do you want to know one day how will you stand before God? Because if that moment comes and you have the slightest inklings of fear and shame, do you know who's going to come to your side right away and comfort you? The man who is at God's right hand right now, who is in the most holy place. Do you remember when he told the disciples in the upper room, it would be better for me to go away right now? And the disciples said, no, that wouldn't be better. No, that wouldn't be better. Now you know why it would be better. Because he had a ministration or a duty to perform, not on earth in a copy-like temple, but in the real temple, the abode of God. And he's ministering there on your behalf right now. Now, you might say, I don't even know what he does up there. Well, just come back next week and the week after that and the week after that. Because that's exactly what the author to Hebrews will show you. That's what he does. He will do everything. He will meet all your basic and even some of the most extravagant needs of your heart. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, thank you for our time together. Thank you that we really don't have to live and shrink back. May we in this week and in coming weeks understand that in the new covenant, there's something that the old covenant approached, that's for sure. It did approach it. It offered sort of a remedial or a provisional kind of assurance, but not like the ministrations of this high priest. For he is one who has done things sort of, he's so unique that it's a once in a universe's opportunity. That he came into this world and that he offered his own life as an atonement for sin and then rose with indestructible life and presents himself not on earth but in heaven as an atonement for his people and prays on their behalf just like a good high priest is supposed to do. And he'll never die and he'll never become wayward himself like the old Aaronic priesthood and he will never lead his people astray. And none of us will ever, ever, ever slip out of his hands. And we pray in his name. Amen. And you are dismissed.